Gamal, he said then. Zayd nodded. Now it's yours, she said with a smile. Bastian took the belt and held it irresolutely in his hand. Would you like to try it now? She asked, just to see how it works. To Bastian's surprise, the belt was a perfect fit, but it gave him a most unpleasant feeling not to see his own body. He wanted to take the belt off, but that wasn't so easy, since he could see neither the buckle nor his own hands. Help! He cried in a panic, suddenly afraid that he would never find the buckle and would remain invisible forever. You have to learn to handle it, said Zayd. I had the same trouble at first. Permit me to help you, my lord and master. She reached into the empty air. A moment later, she had unfastened the belt, and Bastian was relieved to see himself again. He laughed, while Zayd drew smoke from her water pipe, and smiled. If nothing else, she had cheered him up. Now you are safe from harm, she said gently, and that means more to me than you can imagine. Harm? Asked Bastian, still slightly befuddled. What sort of harm? Oh, no one can contend with you, Zayd whispered, not if you are wise. The danger is inside you, and that's why it's hard to protect you against it. Inside me? What does that mean? A wise person stands above things. He neither loves nor hates. But you, my lord, set store by friendship. Your heart should be as cold and indifferent as a snow-covered mountain peak. And it isn't. That's why someone can harm you. Someone? What someone? Someone you still care for, in spite of all his insolence. Speak more plainly. That rude, arrogant little savage from the greenskin country, my lord. Atreyu? Yes, and that outrageous, impertinent Falcor. You think they'd want to harm me? Bastian could hardly keep from laughing. Zayd bowed her head and said nothing. I'll never believe that, said Bastian. I won't listen to another word. Zayd still said nothing. She bowed her head still lower. After a long silence, Bastian asked, What do you suppose Atreyu is plotting? My lord, Zayd whispered, I wish I hadn't spoken. Well, now that you've started, Bastian cried, tell me everything. Stop beating about the bush. What do you know? I tremble at your anger, my lord, Zayd stammered, and true enough, she was all a tremble. But even if it costs me my life, I will tell you. Atreyu is plotting to take the childlike empress's amulet away from you, by stealth or by force. For a moment, Bastian could hardly breathe. Can you prove it? He asked. Zayd shook her head. My knowledge, she murmured, is not of the kind that can be proved. Then keep it to yourself, said Bastian, the blood rising to his face, and don't malign the truest, bravest boy in all Fantastica. With that, he jumped out of the litter and left her. Zayd's fingers played with the snake's head, and her green and red eyes glowed. After a while, she smiled again. Violet smoke rose from her mouth, and she whispered, You will see, my lord and master. The belt, Gamal, will show you. When the camp was set up that night, Bastian went to his tent. He ordered Ilwan, the blue djinn, not to admit anyone, and especially not Zayd. He wanted to be alone and to think. What the sorceress had told him about Atreyu hardly seemed worth troubling his head about. He had something else on his mind. those few words she had dropped about wisdom. He had been through so much. He had known joy and fear, discouragement and triumph. He had rushed from wish fulfillment to wish fulfillment, never stopping to rest. And nothing had brought him calm and contentment. To be wise was to be above joy and sorrow, fear and pity, ambition and humiliation. It was to hate nothing and to love nothing, and above all, to be utterly indifferent to the love and hate of others. A truly wise man attached no importance to anything. Nothing could upset him, and nothing could harm him. Yes, to be like that would be his final wish, the wish that would bring him to what he really wanted. Now he thought he understood what Grogramon had meant by those words, and so he wished to become wise, the wisest being in all Fantastica. A little later, he stepped out of his tent. The moon cast its light on a landscape that he had scarcely noticed up until then. The tent city lay in a hollow, ringed about by strangely shaped mountains. The silence was complete. The hollow was fairly well wooded, while on the mountain slopes the vegetation became more sparse, and farther up there was none at all. The peaks formed all manner of figures, almost as though a giant sculptor had shaped them. No breeze was blowing, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. The stars glittered, and seemed nearer than usual. At the top of one of the highest peaks, Bastian made out a sort of cupola. It seemed to be inhabited, for it gave off a faint light.
"I've noticed it too, my lord," said Ilwan in his rasping voice.
He was standing at his post by the entrance to the tent.
"What can it be?"
He had no sooner spoken than Bastian heard a strange cry in the distance. It suggested the long, drawn-out hooting of an owl, but it was deeper and louder. It sounded a second and then a third time, but now there were several voices. Owls they were indeed, six in number, as Bastian was soon to find out. Coming from the direction of the cupola, they glided at an incredible speed on almost motionless wings. Soon they were close enough for Bastian to see how amazingly large they were. Their eyes glittered, and their erect ears were capped with bundles of down. Their flight was soundless, but as they landed, a faint whirring of their wings could be heard. Then they were sitting on the ground in front of Bastian's tent, swiveling their heads with their great round eyes in all directions. Bastian went up to them. "Who are you?" he asked. "And who are you looking for?"
"We were sent by Ushtu, the mother of intuition," said one of the six owls. "We are messengers from Gigam, the star cloister."
"What sort of cloister is that?" Bastian asked.
"It is the home of wisdom," said another of the owls, "where the monks of knowledge live."
"And who is Ushtu?" Bastian asked.
"One of the three deep thinkers who direct the cloister and instruct the monks," said a third owl. "We are the night messengers, which puts us in her department." "If it were daytime," said a fourth owl, "Shukri, the father of vision, would have sent his messengers, who are eagles. And in the twilight hours, between day and night, Yisipu, the son of reason, sends his messengers, who are foxes."
"Who are Shukri and Yisipu?"
"They are the other deep thinkers, our superiors."
"And what are you doing here?"
"We are looking for the great knower," said the sixth owl. "The three deep thinkers know he is in this tent city, and have sent us to beg him for illumination."
"The great knower?" asked Bastian. Who's that?
His name, replied all six owls at once, is Bastian Balthazar Books.
You found him, said Bastian. It's me. They bowed low, which because of their jerky movements looked almost comical in spite of their great size.
The three deep thinkers, said the first owl, beg you humbly and respectfully to visit them. They hope you will solve a problem they have been trying in vain to solve all their long lives.
Bastian stroked his chin thoughtfully. Very well, he answered after a while. But I must take my two disciples with me.
There are six of us, said the owl. Two of us will carry each one of you.
Bastian turned to the blue djinn. Ilwan, he said, bring me Atreyu and Xeid. The djinn bowed and went his way. What is this problem they want me to solve? Bastian asked.
Oh, great knower, said one of the owls. We are only poor ignorant messengers. We don't even belong to the lowest rank of the monks of knowledge. How could we possibly have cognizance of the problem which the deep thinkers in all their long lives have been unable to solve?
A few minutes later, Ilwan came back with Atreyu and Xeid. On the way, he had told them what it was all about. As he stood before Bastian, Atreyu asked in an undertone, Why me?
Indeed, said Xeid, why him?
You will find out, said Bastian. With admirable foresight, the owls had brought trapezes, one for every two owls. Bastian, Atreyu, and Xeid sat on the bars, and the great night birds, each holding a trapeze rope in its claws, rose into the air. When the travellers reached the star cloister of Gigam, they found that the great cupola was only the uppermost part of a large building composed of many cubical compartments. It had innumerable little windows, and its outer wall might have been taken for the continuation of a sheer cliff. An unbidden visitor could hardly have gained admittance to the place. The cubical compartments contained the cells of the monks of knowledge, the libraries, the refectories, and the lodgings of the messengers. The meeting hall, where the three deep thinkers delivered their lectures, was situated under the cupola. The monks of knowledge were fantasticans of all kinds, from every part of the realm. But anyone wishing to enter the cloister had to break off all contact with family and country. The lives of these monks were hard and frugal, devoted exclusively to knowledge. The community was far from accepting all applicants. The examinations were difficult, and the three deep thinkers set the highest standards. Thus there were seldom more than 300 monks in the cloister at one time, but these were by far the most intelligent persons in all Fantastica. Occasionally the community dwindled to 7 members, but even then there was no thought of relaxing the entrance requirements. At the moment, the monks and monkesses numbered roughly 200. When Bastian, followed by Atreyu and Xeid, was led into the large lecture hall, he saw a motley assortment of fantasticans, who differed from his own retinue only in that they were all dressed in rough, dark brown monks' robes. A wandering cliff or a tiny must have looked very strange in such an outfit. The superiors of the order, the three deep thinkers, were built like humans, except for their heads. Ushtu, the mother of intuition, had the head of an owl. Shirkri, the father of vision, the head of an eagle. And Isipu, the son of reason, the head of a fox. They sat in raised stone chairs and looked enormous. The sight of them seemed to intimidate Atreyu and even Xeid, but Bastian stepped right up to them. With a motion of his head, Shukri, who was evidently the oldest of the three and was sitting in the middle, indicated an empty chair facing the deep thinkers. Bastian sat down in it. After a prolonged silence, Shirkri spoke. He spoke softly, but his voice sounded surprisingly deep and full.
Since time immemorial, we have been pondering the enigma of our world. Isipu's reasonings in the matter are different from Ushtu's intuitions, and Ushtu's intuitions differ from my vision, which in turn is different from Isipu's reasonings. This is intolerable, and must not be allowed to go on. That is why we have asked the Great Knower to come here and instruct us. Are you willing?
I am, said Bastian.
Then, O Great Knower, hear our question. What is Fantastica?
After a short silence, Bastian replied, Fantastica is the never-ending story.
Give us time to understand your answer, said Shirkri. Let us meet again here tomorrow at the same hour.
Silently, the three deep thinkers and the monks of knowledge arose, and all left the hall. Bastian, Atreyu, and Xeide were led to guest cells, where a simple meal awaited them. Their beds were wooden planks covered with rough woolen blankets. Though this didn't matter to Bastian and Atreyu, Xeide would have liked to conjure up a more comfortable bed. But she soon found to her dismay that her magic powers were without effect in this cloister. Late the following night, the monks and the three deep thinkers met again in the great meeting hall. Once again, Bastian occupied the high seat. Xeide and Atreyu sat to the left and right of him. This time it was Ushtu, the mother of intuition, who scrutinized Bastian with her great owl's eyes and said,
We have meditated on your answer, O Great Knower. But a new question has occurred to us. If, as you say, Fantastica is the never-ending story, where is this never-ending story to be found?
After a short silence, Bastian replied,
In a book bound with copper-colored silk. Give us time to understand your words, said Ushtu. Let us meet again tomorrow at the same hour.
When they had gathered in the meeting hall the following night, Isipu, the son of reason, took the floor.
Again we have meditated on your answer, O Great Knower, he said, and again a new question comes to perplex us. If our world, Fantastica, is a never-ending story, and if this never-ending story is in a book bound in copper-colored silk, where, then, is this book?
After a short silence, Bastian replied,
In the attic of a schoolhouse.
O Great Knower, said the fox-headed Isipu, we do not doubt the truth of what you say. But now we would like to ask you to let us see this truth. Can you do that?
Bastian thought it over.
Then he said, I believe I can.
Atreyu looked at Bastian with surprise. Xeide, too, had a questioning look in her red and green eyes.
Let us meet again tomorrow night at the same hour, said Bastian. But not here. Let us meet on the roof of the Star Cloister. And then you must keep your eyes fixed on the heavens.
The following night was as clear as the three before it. At the appointed hour, the three deep thinkers and all the monks of knowledge were gathered on the roof of the Star Cloister. Atreyu and Xeide, who had no idea what Bastian was up to, were there too. Bastian climbed to the top of the great cupola and looked around. For the first time, he saw the ivory tower far off on the horizon, shimmering in the moonlight. He took the stone Altsahir from his pocket. It sent out a soft glow. He then called to mind the inscription he had seen on the door of the Amaganth library. But if he says my name a second time, from the end to the beginning, I will glow in one moment with the light of 100 years. He held the stone up high and cried out, Rehast La! At that moment there came a flash of lightning so bright that the stars paled and the dark cosmic space behind them was illumined. And that space was the schoolhouse attic with its age-blackened beams. In a moment the vision passed, and the light of 100 years was gone. Al-Zahir had vanished without a trace. It was some time before the eyes of those present, including Bastian's, became accustomed to the feeble light of the moon and the stars. Shaken by what they had seen, all gathered in the great lecture hall. Bastian was the last to enter. The monks of knowledge and the three deep thinkers arose from their seats and bowed low to him.
I have no words, said Shirkri, with which to thank you for that flash of illumination, O great knower. For in that mysterious attic I glimpsed a being of my own kind, an eagle.
You are mistaken, Shirkri, said the owl-faced Ushtu with a gentle smile. I saw the creature plainly. It was an owl.
You are both mistaken, cried Yisipu, his eyes aflame. That being is a relative of mine, a fox.
Shirkri raised his hands in horror.
Here we are, back where we started, he said. You alone, O great knower, can answer this new question. Which of us is right?
Smiling serenely, Bastian replied, All three. Give us time to understand your answer, said Ushtu. All the time you wish, Bastian replied, for we shall be leaving you now. Bitter disappointment could be read on the faces of the three deep thinkers and of the monks of knowledge. They implored Bastian to stay longer, or better still, forever. But with a rather disrespectful shrug, he declined. Whereupon the six messengers carried him and his two disciples back to the tent city. That night the usual harmony of the three deep thinkers was disturbed by a first radical difference of opinion, which years later led to the breakup of the community. Then Ushtu, the mother of intuition, Shirkri, the father of vision, and Yisipu, the son of reason, each founded a cloister of his own. But that is another story, and shall be told another time. That night, Bastian lost all memory of having gone to school. The attic and the stolen book bound in copper-colored silk vanished from his mind. And he even stopped asking himself how he had come to Fantastica. 22. The Battle for the Ivory Tower. Vigilant scouts returned to camp, reporting that the ivory tower was not far off and could be reached in 2, or at the most, 3 days' marches. But Bastian seemed irresolute. He kept ordering rest stops, but before the troops were half settled, he would make them start out again. No one knew why he was behaving so strangely, and no one dared ask him. Since his great feat at the Star Cloister, he had been unapproachable, even for Xeide. All sorts of conjectures were rife, but most of the travelling companions were quite willing to obey his contradictory orders. Great wise men, they thought, often strike the common run of people as unpredictable. Atreyu and Falcor were equally at a loss. The incident at the Star Cloister had baffled them completely. Within Bastian, two feelings were at war, and he was unable to silence either one. He longed to meet Moonchild. Now that he was famous and admired throughout Fantastica, he could approach her as an equal. But at the same time, he was afraid she would ask him to return Orin to her. And then what? Would she try to send him back to the world he had almost forgotten? He didn't want to go back. and he wanted to keep the gem. But then he had another idea. Was it so certain that she wanted it back? Maybe she would let him have it as long as he wished. Maybe she had made him a present of it, and it was his for good. At such moments he could hardly wait to see her again. He rushed the caravan on. But then, assailed by doubts, he would order a stop and think it all over again. After alternating forced marches and prolonged delays, the procession finally reached the edges of the famous labyrinth, the immense flower garden with its winding avenues and pathways. On the horizon, the ivory tower gleamed white against the gold-shimmering evening sky. Awed by the splendor and beauty of the sight, the army of Fantasticans stood silent. And so did Bastian. Even Xeite's face showed a look of wonderment which had never been seen before, and which soon vanished. Atreyu and Falcor, who were in the rear of the procession, remembered how different the labyrinth had looked the last time they had seen it, wasted with the ravages of the nothing. Now it was greener and more flourishing than ever before. Bastian decided to go no farther that day, and the tents were pitched for the night. He sent out messengers to bring greetings to Moonchild, and let her know that he would be arriving at the ivory tower next day. Then he lay down in his tent and tried to sleep. He tossed and turned on his cushions. His worries left him no peace. But he was far from suspecting that this would be his worst night since coming to Fantastica. Toward midnight, soon after falling into a restless sleep, he was awakened by excited whisperings outside his tent. He got up and went out. "What's going on?" he asked sternly.
"This messenger," replied Ilwan, the blue djinn, "claims he is bringing you news so important that it can't wait until tomorrow."
The messenger, whom Ilwan had picked up by the collar, was a Nimbli, a creature bearing a certain resemblance to a rabbit, except that its coat was of bright-colored feathers instead of fur. Nimblies are among the swiftest runners in Fantastica, and can cover enormous distances with incredible speed. When running, they become almost invisible, except for the trail of dust clouds they leave behind them. That is why the Nimbli had been chosen as messenger. After running to the ivory tower and back in next to no time, he was desperately out of breath when the djinn set him down in front of Bastian.
"Forgive me, sire," he said, bowing and panting. "Forgive me if I make so bold as to disturb your rest, but you would have every reason to be displeased with me if I failed to do so. Moonchild is not in the ivory tower. She has not been there for a long, long time, and no one knows where she is."
Suddenly, Bastian felt cold and empty inside.
"You must be mistaken. That can't be. The other messengers will tell you the same thing when they get back, sire."
After a long silence, Bastian said tonelessly,
"Thank you. Dismissed."
He went back into his tent, sat down on his bed, and buried his head in his hands. This seemed impossible. Moonchild must have known he was on his way to her. Could it be that she didn't want to see him again? Or had something happened to her? No. How could anything happen to her in her own realm? But the fact remained, she was gone. Which meant that he didn't have to return Orin to her. At the same time, he felt bitterly disappointed that he wouldn't be seeing her again. Whatever her reasons may have been, he found her behavior unbelievable. No, insulting. Then he remembered what Falkir and Atreyu had told him, that no one could meet the childlike empress more than once. The thought made him so unhappy that he suddenly longed for Atreyu and Falcor. He needed someone to talk to confide in. Then he had an idea. If he put on the belt Gamal and made himself invisible, he could enjoy their comforting presence without mentioning the humiliation he felt. He opened the ornate casket, took out the belt, and put it on. Then, after waiting until he had got used to the unpleasant sensation of not seeing himself, he went out and wandered about the tent city in search of Atreyu and Falkor. Wherever he went, he heard excited whispers, figures darted from tent to tent, and here and there several creatures were huddled together, talking and gesticulating. By then the other messengers had returned, and the news that Moonchild was not in the ivory tower had spread like wildfire. Atreyu and Falkor were under a flowering rosemary tree at the very edge of the camp. Atreyu was sitting with his arms folded, looking fixedly in the direction of the ivory tower. The luck dragon lay beside him, with his great head on the ground. "That was my last hope," said Atreyu. "I thought she might make an exception for him, and let him return the amulet. Now all is lost."
"She must know what she is doing," said Falkor.
At that moment, Bastian located them, and sat down invisibly nearby. "Is it certain?" Atreyu murmured. "He mustn't be allowed to keep Orin."
"What will you do?" Falkor asked. "He won't give it up of his own free will."
"Then I'll have to take it from him," said Atreyu. At those words, Bastian felt the ground sinking from under him.
"That won't be easy," he heard Falkor saying. "But if you do take it, I trust that he won't be able to get it back."
"That's not so sure," said Atreyu. "He'll still have his great strength and his magic sword."
"But the gem would protect you," said Falkor, "even against him."
"No," said Atreyu, "I don't think so. Not against him."
"And to think," said Falkor with a grim laugh, "that he himself offered it to you on your first night in Amarganth."
Atreyu nodded. "I didn't realize then what would happen."
"How are you going to take it from him?" Falkor asked.
"I'll have to steal it," said Atreyu.
Falkor's head shot up.
With glowing, ruby-red eyes, he stared at Atreyu, who hung his head and repeated in an undertone, "I'll have to. There's no other way."
After a long silence, Falkor asked, "When?"
"It will have to be tonight. Tomorrow may be too late."
Bastian had heard enough.
Slowly he crept away. His only feeling was one of cold emptiness. Everything was indifferent to him now, just as Zayd had said. He went back to his tent and took off the belt Gamal. Then he bade Ilwan bring him the three knights, Husbalt, Hukrian, and Hudorn. As he paced the ground waiting, it came to him that Zayd had foreseen it all. He hadn't wanted to believe her, but now he was obliged to. Zayd, he now realized, was sincerely devoted to him. She was his only true friend. But there was still room for doubt. Perhaps Atreyu wouldn't actually carry out his plan. Maybe he had already repented. In that case, Bastian wouldn't ever mention it, though friendship now meant nothing to him. That was over and done with. When the three knights appeared, he told them he had reason to believe that a thief would come to his tent that night. When they agreed to keep watch and lay hands on the thief, whoever he might be, he went to Xeid's coral litter. She lay sound asleep, attended by her five giants in their black armor, who stood motionless on guard. In the darkness, they looked like five boulders. "I wish you to obey me," Bastian said softly. Instantly, all five turned their black iron faces toward him.
"Command us, master of our mistress," said one in a metallic voice.
"Do you think you can handle Falkor the Luck Dragon?" Bastian asked.
"That depends on the will that guides us," said the metallic voice.
"It is my will," said Bastian.
"Then there is no one we cannot handle,"
was the answer. Good. Then go close to where he is. He pointed. That way. As soon as Atreyu leaves him, take him prisoner, but keep him there. I'll have you called when I want you.
Master of our mistress,
the metallic voice replied.
It shall be done.
The five black giants marched off in step. Zayd smiled in her sleep. Bastian went back to his tent, but once in sight of it, he hesitated. If Atreyu should really attempt to steal the gem, he didn't want to be there when they seized him. He sat down under a nearby tree and waited, wrapped in his silver mantle. Slowly, the time passed. The sky paled in the east. It would soon be morning. Bastian was beginning to hope that Atreyu had abandoned his project, when suddenly he heard a tumult in his tent. And a moment later, Hukrion led Atreyu out, with his arms chained behind his back. The two other knights followed. Bastian dragged himself to his feet and stood leaning against the tree. So he's actually done it, he muttered to himself. Then he went to his tent. He couldn't bear to look at Atreyu, and Atreyu too kept his eyes to the ground. Ilwan, said Bastian to the blue djinn, wake the whole camp. I want everyone here, and tell the black giants to bring Falkor. The djinn hurried off with the rasping cry of an eagle. Wherever he went, the denizens of the tents, large and small, began to stir. He didn't defend himself at all, said Hukrion, with a movement of his head toward Atreyu, who was standing there motionless, with eyes downcast. Bastian turned away and sat down on a stone. By the time the five armored giants appeared with Falkor, a large crowd had gathered. At the approach of the stamping metallic steps, the crowd opened up a passage. Falkor was not chained, and the armed guards were not holding him, but merely marching to the left and right of him with drawn swords.
He offered no resistance, master of our mistress, said one of the metallic voices.
Falkor lay down on the ground at Atreyu's feet and closed his eyes. A long silence followed. Creatures poured in from the camp and craned their necks to see what was going on. Only Xeid was absent. Little by little, the whispering died down. All eyes shuttled back and forth between Bastian and Atreyu, who stood motionless, looking like stone statues in the grey morning light. At length, Bastian spoke. Atreyu, he said, you tried to steal Moonchild's amulet and take it for yourself, and you, Falkor, were an accomplice to his plan. Not only have you both been untrue to our old friendship, you have also been guilty of disobedience to Moonchild, who gave me the gem. Do you confess your wrong? Atreyu cast a long glance at Bastian. Then he nodded. Bastian's voice failed him. It was some time before he could go on. I have not forgotten, Atreyu, that it was you who brought me to Moonchild. I have not forgotten Falkor's singing in Amarganth. So I will spare your lives, the lives of a thief and of a thief's accomplice. Do what you will, just so you go away, the farther the better, and never let me lay eyes on you again. I banish you forever. I have never known you. He bade Hukrion remove Atreyu's chains, then he turned away. Atreyu stood motionless for a long while. Then he cast another glance at Bastian. It looked as if he wanted to say something, but changed his mind. He bent down to Falkor and whispered something in his ear. The luck dragon opened his eyes and sat up. Atreyu jumped on his back, and Falkor rose into the air. He flew straight into the brightening morning sky, and though his movements were heavy and sluggish, he soon vanished in the distance. Bastian went to his tent and threw himself down on his bed. At last,
You have achieved true greatness, said a soft voice. Now you've stopped caring for anything. Now nothing can move you. Bastian sat up. It was Xeid. She was squatting in the darkest corner of the tent. You? Said Bastian. How did you get in? Xeid smiled. Oh, my lord and master, no guards can shut me out. Only your command can do that. Do you wish to send me away? Bastian lay back and closed his eyes. After a while, he muttered, It's all the same to me. Go or stay. For a long while, she watched him from under her half-lowered lids. Then she asked, What are you thinking about, my lord and master? Bastian turned away and did not reply. It was plain to Xeid that this was no time to leave him to himself. In such a mood, he was capable of slipping away from her. She must comfort him and cheer him up, in her own way, for she was determined to hold him to the course she had planned for him and for herself. She knew that in the present juncture, no magic belts or tricks would suffice. It would take stronger medicine, the strongest medicine available to her, namely, Bastian's secret wishes. She sat down beside him and whispered in his ear, When, O Lord and Master, will you go to the Ivory Tower? I don't know, said Bastian. What can I do there if Moonchild is gone? You could go and wait for her. Bastian turned to face Xeid. Do you think she'll be back? He had to repeat his question more insistently before Xeid replied, No, I don't believe so. I believe she has had to leave Fantastica forever, and that you, my lord and master, are her successor. Slowly, Bastian sat up and looked into Xeid's red and green eyes. It was some time before he grasped the full meaning of her words. I? He gasped, and his cheeks broke out in red spots. Do you find the idea so frightening? Xeid whispered. She gave you the emblem of her power. Now she has left you her empire. Now, my lord and master, you will be the childlike emperor. It is only your right. You not only saved Fantastica by your coming, you also created it. All of us, I too, are your creatures. Why should you, the great knower, fear to take the power that is rightfully yours? Bastian's eyes glowed with a cold fever. And then Xeid spoke to him of a new Fantastica, a world moulded in every detail to Bastian's taste, where he could create and destroy just as he pleased, where every creature, good or bad, beautiful or ugly, wise or foolish, would be the product of his will alone. And he would reign supreme and inscrutable, playing an everlasting game with the destinies of his subjects. Then alone, he concluded, will you be truly free, free from all obstacles, free to do as you please. Weren't you trying to find out what you really and truly want? Well, now you know. That same morning they broke camp, and led by Bastian and Xeid in the coral litter, the great procession set out for the Ivory Tower. A well-nigh endless column moved along the twining paths of the labyrinth. In the late afternoon, when the head of the column reached the Ivory Tower, the last stragglers had barely entered the great flowering maze. Bastian could not have wished for a more festive reception,
On every roof and battlement stood elves with gleaming trumpets, blaring away at the top of their lungs. The jugglers juggled, the astrologers proclaimed Bastian's greatness and good fortune, the bakers baked cakes as big as mountains, the ministers and councillors escorted the coral litter through the teeming crowd on the high street, which wound in an ever-narrowing spiral up the conical tower to the great gate leading into the palace. Followed by Xeite and the dignitaries, Bastian climbed the snow-white steps of the broad stairway, traversed halls and corridors, passed through a second gate, through a garden full of ivory animals, trees and flowers, mounted higher and higher, crossed a bridge, and passed through the last gate. He was heading for the Magnolia Pavilion at the very top of the tower. But the blossom was closed, and the last stretch of the way was so steep and smooth that no one could climb it. Bastian remembered that the wounded Atreyu had not been able to climb that slope, not by his own strength at least, because no one who has ever reached the Magnolia Pavilion can say how he got there. For this victory must come as a gift. But Bastian was not Atreyu. If anyone was now entitled to bestow the gift of this victory, it was he, and he had no intention of letting anything stop him. "Bring workmen," he commanded. "I want them to cut steps in this smooth surface. I wish to make my residence up there."
"Sire," one of the oldest councillors ventured to object, "that is where our golden-eyed commander of wishes lives when she is here."
"Do as you're told,"
Bastian roared at him. The dignitaries turned pale and shrank back from him, but they obeyed. Workmen arrived with mallets and chisels. But try as they might, they couldn't so much as chip the smooth surface of the dome. The chisels leapt from their hands without leaving the slightest dent.
"Think of something else," said Bastian angrily. "My patience is wearing thin."
Then he turned away. And while waiting for the Magnolia Pavilion to be made accessible, he and his retinue, consisting chiefly of Xeite, the three knights, Husbald, Hukrian and Hudorn, and Ilwan, the blue djinn, took possession of the remaining rooms of the palace. That same night he summoned all the ministers and councillors who had served Moonchild to a meeting in the large circular hall where the Congress of Physicians had once met. There he informed them that the golden-eyed commander of wishes had left him, Bastian Balthazar Books, power over the endless Phantastigan Empire, and that he was now taking her place. In conclusion, he demanded perfect obedience. "Even, or I might say especially," he added, "when my decisions are beyond your understanding, for I am not of your kind." Then he announced that in exactly 77 days he would crown himself childlike emperor of Phantastica, and that the event would be celebrated with such splendor that it would outshine anything ever done in Phantastica. And he ordered the councillors to send messengers forthwith to every part of the realm, for he wished every nation of the Phantastican Empire to be represented at his coronation. Thereupon Bastian withdrew, leaving the councillors and other dignitaries alone with their bewilderment. They didn't know what to do. What they had heard sounded so monstrous that for a long while they could only stand there silently, hanging their heads. Then they began to deliberate, and after many hours they came to the conclusion that they would have to obey Bastian's commands, for he bore the emblem of the childlike empress, and that entitled him to obedience regardless of whether Moonchild had really abdicated in his favour, or whether this was just another of her unfathomable decisions. And so the messengers were sent, and all Bastian's orders were carried out. He himself took no further interest in the coronation, but left all the details to Xeite, who kept the whole court so busy that hardly anyone had time to think. During the next days and weeks, Bastian spent most of his time in the room he had chosen, staring into space and doing nothing. He would have liked to wish for something, or to make up a story to amuse himself, but nothing occurred to him. He felt hollow and empty. At length, he hit on the idea of wishing for Moonchild to come to him. If he was really all-powerful, if all his wishes came true, she would have to obey him. For whole nights he sat there whispering, "Moonchild, come, you must come, I command you to come." He thought of her glance, which had lain in his heart like a glittering treasure. But she did not come, and the more he tried to make her come, the fainter became his memory of that glitter in his heart, until in the end all was darkness within him. He convinced himself that everything would come right again if only he could be in the Magnolia Pavilion. Time and again he went up to the workmen and tried to spur them with promises or threats, but all to no avail. Ladders broke, nails bent, chisels split. Hukrian, Husbald, and Hudorn, with whom Bastian would gladly have chatted or played games, were as good as useless. In the deepest cellar of the ivory tower, they had discovered wine. There they sat, day and night, drinking, playing dice, bellowing silly songs, or quarrelling, and as often as not, attacking one another with their swords. Sometimes they staggered up and down the high street, molesting the fairies, elves, and other female denizens of the tower. "What do you expect, sire?" they said, when Bastian found fault with them. "You must give us something to do." But Bastian couldn't think of anything, and bade them wait until his coronation, though he himself couldn't have said what difference that would make. Little by little, the weather changed for the worse. Sunsets of liquid gold became more infrequent. Almost always the sky was grey and overcast, not a breeze stirred. The air grew sultry and lifeless. The day appointed for the coronation was near. The messengers returned. Some brought delegates from remote corners of Fantastica, but others arrived empty-handed, for many of the nations refused out of hand to be represented at the ceremony, and in some countries there had been veiled or open rebellion. Bastian stared into space. "Once you are emperor," said Xeide, "you will put the house in order." "I want them to want what I want," said Bastian. But already Xeide had hurried off to make new arrangements. And then came the day of the coronation that did not take place. It went down in the history of Fantastica as the day of the bloody battle for the Ivory Tower. There was no dawn that morning. The sky was too covered with thick, leaden-grey clouds. The air was almost too heavy to breathe. Working hand in hand with the Ivory Tower's 14 masters of ceremony, Xeide had drawn up an elaborate program for the celebration. Beginning early in the morning, bands on all the streets and squares played music such as had never been heard in the Ivory Tower, strident yet monotonous. None who heard it could help jiggling his feet and dancing. The musicians wore black masks. No one knew who they were or where Xeide had found them. Every roof and housefront was decorated with bright-coloured flags and pennants, but they hung sadly limp, for there was no wind. Along the high street and on the wall around the palace, hundreds of pictures had been set up, ranging in size from small to enormous, and all showed the same face, Bastian's. Since the Magnolia Pavilion was still inaccessible, Xeide had prepared another site for the coronation. The throne was to be installed at the foot of the ivory steps near the palace gate, where the winding high street ended. Thousands of golden censers were smouldering, and the smoke, with its lulling yet exciting fragrance, drifted slowly up the steps and down the high street, finding its way into every last nook and cranny. The armored giants were everywhere. Only Xeid knew how she had managed to multiply the 5 she had left into such an army. And as if that were not enough, 50 of them were mounted on gigantic horses, which were also made of black metal, and moved in perfect unison. The armored horsemen escorted a throne up the high street in a triumphal procession. It was as big as a church door, and consisted entirely of mirrors of every size and shape. Only the cushion on the seat was covered with copper-colored silk. Strangely, this enormous glittering object glided up the spiral street unaided, without being pushed or pulled. It seemed to have a life of its own. When it stopped at the great ivory gate, Bastian stepped out of the palace and sat down on it. In the midst of all that glitter and splendor, he looked like a tiny doll. The crowd of onlookers, who were held back by a cordon of armored giants, burst into cheers. But for some inexplicable reason, their cheers sounded thin and shrill. Then began the most tedious and wearisome part of the ceremony. The messengers and delegates from all over the Phantastigan Empire had to form a line, which extended from the mirrored throne down the entire spiraling high street and deep into the labyrinthine garden. Every single delegate, when his turn came, had to bow down before the throne, touch the ground 3 times with his forehead, kiss Bastian's right foot, and say, "In the name of my nation and my species, I beseech you, to whom we all owe our existence, to crown yourself childlike emperor of Phantastica." This had been going on for 2 or 3 hours, when a sudden tremor passed through the crowd. A young fawn came dashing up the high street, reeled with exhaustion, pulled himself together, ran till he reached Bastian, and threw himself on the ground, gasping for breath. Bastian bent down to him. "How dare you interrupt this august ceremony?" "War, sire!" cried the fawn. "Atreyu has gathered a host of rebels and is on his way here with 3 armies. They demand that you give up Orin. If you will not, they mean to take it by force." The rousing music and the shrill cries of jubilation gave way to a deathly silence. Bastian turned pale. Then the 3 knights, Husbald, Hukrion, and Hudorn, appeared on the run. They seemed to be in a remarkably good humor. "At last, there's something for us to do, sire," all 3 cried at once. "Leave it to us. Just get on with your celebration. We'll round up a few good men and get after those rebels. We'll teach them a lesson they won't forget so soon." Among the thousands of creatures present, quite a few were utterly useless for military purposes, but most were able to handle some weapon or to fight with their teeth or claws. All these gathered around the 3 knights, who led their army away. Bastian remained behind with the not-so-martial multitude to complete the ceremony. But his heart was no longer in it. Time and again his eyes veered toward the horizon, which he could see from his throne. Great clouds of dust showed him that Atreyu's army was no joke. "Don't worry," said Xeid, who had stepped up to Bastian. "My armored giants haven't begun to fight yet. They'll defend your ivory tower. No one can stand up to them, except for you and your sword." A few hours later, the first battle reports came in. Atreyu had enlisted almost all the greenskins, at least 200 centaurs, 850 rock chewers, 5 luck dragons led by Falkor, who kept attacking from the air, a squadron of giant eagles who had flown from the mountains of destiny, and innumerable other creatures, even a sprinkling of unicorns. Though far inferior in numbers to the troops led by the knights Hukrion, Husbald, and Hudorn, Atreyu's army fought so vigorously that they were soon approaching the ivory tower. Bastian wanted to go out and lead his army in person, but Xeid advised against it. "Oh, lord and master," she said, "it is unseemly for the Emperor of Phantastica to take up arms. Leave that to your faithful subjects."
All day the battle raged. The entire labyrinth became a trampled, blood-soaked battlefield. By late afternoon, despite the stubborn resistance of Bastion's army, the rebels had reached the foot of the ivory tower. Then Xeide sent in her armored giants, both mounted and on foot, and they wrought havoc among Atreyu's followers. A detailed account of the battle for the ivory tower would take us too far. To this day, Fantasticans sing countless songs and tell innumerable stories about that day and night, for everyone who took part saw it in his own way. Certain of the stories have it that Atreyu's army included several white magicians, who had the power to oppose Xeide's black magic. Of this we have no certain knowledge, but that would explain how, in spite of the armored giants, Atreyu and his followers were able to take the ivory tower. But there is another, more likely explanation. Atreyu was fighting not for himself, but for his friend, whom he was trying to save by defeating him. The night of the battle was starless, full of smoke and flames. Fallen torches, overturned censers, and shattered lamps had set the tower on fire in many places. The fighters cast eerie shadows. Weapons clashed and battle shouts resounded. Everywhere, through the flames and the darkness, Bastion searched for Atreyu. "Atreyu!" he shouted. "Atreyu, show yourself! Stand up and fight! Where are you?" But the sword Sikander didn't budge from its sheath. Bastion ran from room to room of the palace, then out on the great wall, which at that point was as wide as a street, and was heading for the outer gate where the mirror throne stood, now shattered into a thousand pieces, when he saw Atreyu, sword in hand, coming toward him. They stood face to face, and still Sikander did not budge. Atreyu put the tip of his sword on Bastion's chest. "Give me the amulet," he said, "for your own sake." "Traitor!" cried Bastion. "You are my creature. I created the whole lot of you, including you. So how can you rebel against me? Kneel down and beg forgiveness." "You're mad," cried Atreyu. "You didn't create anything. You owe everything to Moonchild. Give me Orin. Take it if you can." Atreyu hesitated. "Bastion," he said, "why do you force me to defeat you in order to save you?" Bastion tugged at the hilt of his sword. He tugged at it with all his might and finally managed to draw Sikander from its sheath. But it did not leap into his hand of its own accord. And at the same moment a sound was heard, a sound so terrible that even the warriors on the street outside the gate stood as though frozen to the spot, looking up at the two adversaries. Bastion recognized that sound. It was the hideous cracking and grinding he had heard when Grogramman turned to stone. Sikander's light went out, and then Bastion remembered how the lion had predicted what would happen if someone were to draw the sword of his own will. But by then, it was too late to turn back. Atreyu tried to defend himself with his own sword, but wielded by Bastion, Sikander cut it in two and struck Atreyu in the chest. Blood spurted from a gaping wound. Atreyu staggered back and toppled from the wall. But at that moment a white flame shot through the swirling smoke, caught Atreyu in his fall, and carried him away. The white flame was Falkor, the Luck Dragon. Bastion wiped the sweat from his brow with his mantle, and saw that its silver had turned black as the night. Still with the sword Sikander in his hand, he left the wall and went down to the palace courtyard. With Bastion's victory over Atreyu, the fortunes of war shifted. The rebel army, which had seemed sure of victory a moment before, took flight. Bastion felt as if he were caught in a terrible dream and could not wake up. His victory left him with a bitter taste in his mouth, but at the same time he felt wildly triumphant.
Wrapped in his black mantle, clutching the bloody sword, he passed slowly down the high street. The ivory tower was blazing like an enormous torch. Hardly aware of the roaring flames, Bastian went on till he reached the foot of the tower. There he found the remnants of his army waiting for him in the devastated labyrinth, now a far-flung battlefield strewn with the corpses of Fantasticans. Hukrian, Husbolt, and Hudorn were there too, the last two seriously wounded. Ilwan, the blue djinn, was dead. Sayid, holding the belt Gemal, was standing beside his corpse.
"He saved this for you, O Lord and Master," she said.
Bastian took the belt, folded it up, and put it in his pocket. Slowly, he passed his eyes over his companions. Only a few hundred were left. More dead than alive, they looked like a conclave of ghosts in the flickering light of the fires. All had their faces turned toward the ivory tower, which was collapsing piece by piece. The magnolia pavilion at the top flared, its petals opened wide, and one could see that it was empty. Then it, too, was engulfed by the flames. Bastian pointed his sword at the heap of flaming ruins, and his voice cracked as he declared, "This is Atreyu's doing. For this I will pursue him to the ends of the world." Hoisting himself up on one of the gigantic metal horses, he cried, "Follow me!" The horse reared, but he bent it to his will and galloped off into the night. 23. The City of the Old Emperors. While Bastian was racing through the pitch-black night miles ahead, his companions were still making preparations for departure. Most were exhausted, and none had anything approaching Bastian's strength and endurance. Even the armored giants on their metallic horses had a hard time getting started, and the foot-sloggers couldn't manage to fall into their mechanical tramp, tramp, tramp. Zayid's will, which moved them, seemed to have reached the limits of its power. Her coral litter had been devoured by flames. A new conveyance had been built out of shattered weapons and charred planks from the ivory tower, but it looked more like a gypsy wagon than a litter. The rest of the army hobbled and shuffled along as best they could. Even Hukrion, Husbolt, and Hudorn, who had lost their horses, had to hold one another up. No one spoke, but they all knew they would never be able to overtake Bastian. On he galloped through the darkness, his black mantle flapping wildly in the wind, the metallic limbs of his gigantic horse creaking and grinding at every movement as the great hooves pounded the earth. "Gee up!" cried Bastian. "Gee up! Gee up!" The horse wasn't running fast enough for him. He was determined to overtake Atreyu and Falkor at all costs, even if it meant riding this metallic monster to its death. He wanted vengeance. He would have attained the goal of all his wishes if Atreyu hadn't interfered. Bastian had not